The poet Charles Harper Webb is in favor of what he calls a psychotherapeutic approach to the art form. In his essay book, A Million MFAs Are Not Enough, he advocates for the use of wit, energy, enthusiasm, and especially humor, despite the world's suffering.
Humor is so much a part of what humans are. Looked at psychologically, it's a great defense mechanism, but it's not really just a defense mechanism. It's a way of coping. You know, it's a way of seeing the world. It's one way that you don't end up depressed all the time.
He also thinks poetry might build a bigger audience. Hear more about Charles Harper Webb's essay collection and listen to his poetry about baseball, family, and the natural world today on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. Born in Philadelphia but raised in Houston, Charles Harper Webb ended up in Southern California in the 1980s, where he got degrees in both counseling psychology and professional writing. A licensed psychotherapist, he's taught English ever since at California State University. The Guggenheim Fellow has also authored over a dozen books of poetry. We'll hear from his 2015 collection, Brain Camp, and his earlier book of new and selected poems called Shadow Ball, both from the University of Pittsburgh Press. While visiting Kansas City as part of Rutgers University's 2017 Midwest Poet Series, I asked him to read the short foreword to his 2016 essay book, A Million MFAs Are Not Enough. Here's Charles Harper Webb.
Back in the Pleistocene, when I made my living playing rock and roll, I thought that poetry could and should be as popular as Led Zeppelin. I proclaimed with confidence that any reader able to understand and enjoy Time magazine should be able to understand and enjoy at least some contemporary poetry. Years of teaching have taught me that for most readers, any poem worthy of the name will be more challenging than Time. I now accept that Billy Collins, Mary Oliver, and Sharon Olds combined will never approach the popularity of Lil Wayne or Justin Bieber. Still, I believe that with respect to audience and artistry, poetry has shot itself in many portions of its anatomy and keeps blasting. The fact that vast numbers of poems are published every year and a large number of creative writing students and graduates combine to read a few of them does not mean that poetry is on the right track. A million MFAs are not enough to make poetry count in the culture at large. From the publication of Five Stand-Up Poets in 1989 until now, I've tried in poems and essays to counter the forces that have consigned the erstwhile queen of the arts to the tiny corner of the cultural basement where she languishes today. Why don't more Americans like poetry? Why do so many fear and/or ignore it? Why do the majority of prestigiously published, well-reviewed books of contemporary poems seem to me dull as tax code and almost as punishing? What, if anything, might change the situation? Does it need changing? What makes a poem good? What makes one interesting? Are they the same things? What are these things? The essays in this book wrestle with these and other questions, defining problems and suggesting solutions. Many of the essays take the form of craft lectures. Others are more personal. All are, I hope, opinionated but not unreasonable. I favor poems that speak, at least potentially, to a readership beyond the specialist. I believe that meaning exists and expect poems to communicate it, even though it may be hard to paraphrase. I resent poems that, like little enigma codes, require deciphering. I don't like poets to obfuscate, especially when what they've hidden proves to be fool's gold. I like poems that give pleasure and are understandable the first time through, but reward rereading with increased pleasure, depth, and resonance. Such poems enlighten as they entertain. I hope that these essays will do that too.
That's the foreword from A Million MFAs Are Not Enough by Charles Harper Webb. It's a selection of essays all about poetry, and I love what you do in here because you take apart and look at poetry in a very unusual way because you yourself are trained as a psychotherapist. And I love that you bring that to looking at poetry because it gives a fresh way of seeing things.
I have gotten a lot of very favorable response, people saying, thank God somebody's finally saying this. But as I say, I know that there are many others who, if they read it, are probably fulminating quietly somewhere.
I don't know. I mean, what you're trying to do is make it clear that we need to bring poetry back to the people. And the whole idea of a difficult poem with a capital D, which you talk about in one of the later essays, that so many people in academia are just involved with making it more obscure and difficult than it needs to be.
Yeah, that's what they're trained to do, and that's the way that they can do their stuff. I mean, I understand that. A really difficult poem gives a professor something to sink his or her teeth into. So they like that sort of thing. But most people, regular readers, the people that poems I think should be addressed to, they just go, huh?
And then they become scared of it. It was interesting. I was at a poetry reading with one of my college buddies, and she's well read, but she doesn't read poetry. And she says, poetry makes me anxious.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, why? And she goes, I don't always get it. And I said, well, you know, let it wash over you, you know, don't be afraid of it, for God's sake.
It makes people feel stupid. I mean, who wants to read and feel stupid? That's not why I read.
No, of course not. I love the fact that you use Billy Collins as an example, because he is so approachable, and his whole idea is you don't want to whip people with a poem,
right,
you know, you
right.
want them to be able to enjoy it.
The three people that I cited, Billy Collins, Sharon Olds, and Mary Oliver, are all poets who have reached a much wider audience than most poets do. And each of them has caught some flack in one way or another for it.
Yeah. You know, I mentioned that you're a psychotherapist, and one of the things that you do is look at depression in American poetry,
oh, yeah.
a psychotherapeutic approach. But you were saying that there is a time for depressive poems. In fact, one of the things you say is poets don't stop writing depressive poems. You've got to be true to your vision. But you were saying the prejudice in favor of depressive poems must end. And there's this wonderful thing that I'm calling in favor of being happy.
Yeah. Somewhere or another, it began to be assumed that depression was the most advanced philosophical state. And what I observed as a psychotherapist and as a person is that anybody can be depressed. You know, a 12-year-old can look at the world and say, oh, man, it's awful. That doesn't really take anything. That's the state that people would kind of normally get to, the default state. And that doesn't cut it. I don't think that readers in general just want to be completely morose all the time.
But there are times for that.
Of course. That essay was provoked, as it were, by looking at a collection of so-called best American poetry one time and just seeing, wow, these are so depressed. And I just ticked off what they were writing about.
Yeah. It's interesting you mention Best American Poetry because you've been chosen. You've had three.
I like it.
I was thinking you might be in 2016 because Edward Hirsch was the editor of that. And in every one of your books, you thank him. But you were not in the 2016.
No, I guess I didn't make the cut. He's done enough for me. He's been an incredible inspiration and very helpful to me.
So tell us about your relationship with him.
Yeah, well, I had achieved a kind of reputation as a poet, kind of an underground poet. I think I put in some essay, I was like a kind of Bukowski, but more surreal, not an alcoholic, and with better skin.
That's because you're not an alcoholic.
Yeah. And so I published in magazines like the Wormwood Review and California-based magazines, and they were great. And I'm taking nothing away from that. But I felt like I had run up against a wall and that I had written a number of poems that I thought were pretty good in a particular mode, but I was starting to repeat myself. And so I saw that Edward Hirsch, whose poems I knew and liked, had picked Billy Collins for an important award. And I saw that he was teaching at the Aspen Writers Conference. And I said, I'm going to go to that, and I'm going to see if he can help me break through this barrier. Because I was stagnating, and I wasn't achieving what I wanted. I couldn't seem to get out of that underground sort of place, and I did want a wider readership. And so I went there, and he did it. He looked at my poems. He said some really important things to me that I—
Such as?
Well, two things. He said, one, you're very funny, and so you can get away with stuff that you shouldn't allow yourself to get away with because you can get a laugh out of something. And he said, I think you need to be tougher on yourself, especially if you're doing an oral presentation. See, and I'd come from the world of rock and roll. I was a rock front man for a lot of years. And he said, you know, I think you're relying too much on your sense of humor and your showmanship. So you got to be tougher on yourself. And then the next thing he said is, you've got to get so good that they can't keep you out. And that's just the kind of thing that I wanted to hear, because I've got this real work ethic, you know. When I send work out and it gets rejected, that makes me work harder. I say, I'm going to make this so good that you can't say no. Of course, they'll still say no mostly, but it helps me. It's a way to make the poem better, and I'm always trying to make it better. And a couple years after I had that workshop with Ed, I started winning stuff. And I credit Ed with really getting me on track. And it just made me be smarter in my use of humor, because it's not enough to just get a laugh. Although, frankly, I'd rather get a laugh than depress everybody to death. But it made me think, okay, the best humor is always dead serious. And so I want to make the humor that I use work on a number of levels. That's the point. I mean, it would be nuts of me to try to write anything that didn't have humor in it, because my whole outlook is kind of humorous.
I'm talking with Charles Harper Webb on New Letters on the Air. I noticed you introduced yourself as Charles, so you go by Charles. You don't go by Charlie?
Friends call me Charlie sometimes, and that's fine with me. I became Charles Harper Webb because my sister, who is a librarian, said that my books kept being miscataloged. The guy who wrote The Graduate was named Charles Webb. I mean, it's about as common a name as you can get in England. And there was even a Charles H. Webb, because I thought about that, who was a music critic. So my sister, the librarian, said, use Charles Harper Webb, because she would actually go into the Library of Congress catalog and change the cataloging, because so much of my stuff got put under the other Charles Webb. So anyway, that's why it became. I don't really feel like a trinomial sort of guy, but, you know, that's what I write under now. And there isn't anybody else named that.
Yeah. You know, you were saying that you've been rejected a lot, but you've been accepted too. The list of poems in your books that have been published by all these magazines all across the country, I mean, it's a long list. So you must, when you get rejected, you must just put it in another envelope and send it to somebody else? What's your pattern?
No, really, what I do is I look over it again. I'm remembering what Ed said. I said, make it so good they can't say no. And so I will go through it every time. I mean, I have a particular way that I deal with it, because I tend to be kind of a hot-tempered person. So immediately I think, how can they do that? Do they know what they're missing? You know, I'll go through that whole thing. But then I'll say, I'm going to make it better. I'll show you. And that helps me, because in order to get published as many places as I have, believe me, I had to get rejected in three times that many places. In some ways, it's a numbers game. You just have to be relentless. And as I said, I have a good work ethic. I like to work hard. And so that's what I do.
Well, let's talk some about Shadow Ball, new and selected poems. There's no way that any one poem is going to sum it all up, but I thought I would have you read the title poem of this, because it's a wonderful poem, and also because we have the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum here in Kansas City. And baseball comes up in your poetry here and there.
Oh, I love baseball.
Yeah. But I couldn't help but think about the shadow, too, since you're a psychotherapist, and I think of the Jungian
shadow.
Yeah, the Jungian idea of the shadow.
That's a very important concept in my kind of way of looking at the world.
So I thought Shadow Ball might be the one I picked from
Fantastic.
There.
That poem came about because I read about this shadow ball, and I thought, that's a fantastic metaphor. If I take that metaphor, let me see where it goes. I like to enter a poem with no idea where it's going to go. That was just so powerful, the idea of playing baseball without a ball. Shadow ball. Let's say some black guys in the 30s hustled up a baseball game. Then, right away, this tree-trunk-armed Josh Gibson type lambasted their one soggy Spalding with its cover falling off past the sarsaparillas into Okefoke Slough. Next play, the pitcher wound up and threw a fat nothing. The batter swung and smoked a low line drive the shortstop blocked, then fired to the first baseman, who did a split and scooped nothing out of the dirt just as the runner banged the bag. Out! Roared the umpire, and both benches cleared. The Pittsburgh Crawfords, Birmingham Black Barons, New York Black Yankees, even the Indianapolis Clowns beat the best white teams at real baseball. Still, before a game, they'd whip around the horn that spherical hunk of the void they knew so well, slamming it deep, chasing it down so skillfully, few whites who saw them guessed the trick. Black folks were shadows to most white ones anyway, though we whites pioneered the shadow services for which government is famed, and the shadow intelligence that dims high offices across the land, not to mention shadow marriage, where couples make real mortgage payments to shadow companies for shadow homes, have shadow sex, and before they sleep with shadow partners, say, "I love you," without the shadowiest notion what they mean, which is why their kids prefer the well-lit screens of movies and the World Wide Web to baseball, and professional theorists swear there's no real life, real excellence, real meaning, real. And the most enlightened answer to good night is good is a race, class, gender-determined abstraction, and it's not night, the sky just looks that way. Yes, it looks darker every day. Those Negro League All-Stars, Oscar Charleston, Willie Wells, Buck Leonard, Cool Papa Bell, who couldn't stay in white hotels, eat in white restaurants, or play in the so-called major leagues, but who apparently enjoyed life anyway, can be forgiven if they laugh in their all-black graveyards to see shadows reach out black gloves and grab us all.
Shadow Ball, that was the title poem from the collection of new and selected poems by Charles Harper Webb. It's nice to have this collection. It must have been hard to figure out what to put in here and what to
murder.
Leave out.
I mean, every editor has a particular take. Since I started working with Pittsburgh, Ed Ochester has had, you know, input also. So there's a lot of things that go into what poems finally make it into a book, but I consider myself lucky that I have a lot to choose from.
Exactly.
And, Ed Ochester just said, cut it to this. He wanted it to be a certain length.
Right.
And so I just had to say, all right, at some point I just almost shut my eyes and say, you go, you stay, you go, you stay. But I think it's a little more sculpted than that. But a lot of times I did just have to say, oh, I'm sorry, poem. I love you, but you can't be in this.
Oh, I know. That's so tough. Well, you know, that's the nice thing. You can always go back sometime and have
exactly.
Something else that it pulls from. Well, let's talk about your most recent book,
okay.
Green Camp. I absolutely love the opening poem of this collection. And so I'm going to have you read Moth.
Oh, Moth. Okay. Moth. The soul, as we know, is a gray moth at the center of the brain. When we're awake, it sleeps, which makes some people think it isn't there. When we sleep, though, it leaves us through an ear. The things it sees, the thoughts it has outside, are dreams. Once, during a World Series game, a lost soul slipped into the pitcher's ear. Unable to choose what pitch to throw, he dropped onto the mound, clawing his head, and had to be sedated until, as doctors tried to bat it down, the soul fluttered away. Sometimes two souls fly together for a while. The owners say they are in love. They say soulmates. Sometimes these mates may lose each other in the dark or for some reason fly together no more. Then the two people feel sad, though one always feels sadder. When we die, The soul waits until no one's looking, then flies out the least obvious ear, not to heaven, only to the nearest tree, where it settles on a leaf. If there aren't leaves, a twig will do, and seeps inside. This is why children rake leaves into mountains to slide down, and why men fire up a pile of leaves on a cold day and stare into the blaze and will say only, I like the smell. I like the heat. I like the light.
Moth, from the book Brain Camp. I'm talking with Charles Harper Webb, and baseball came up again.
It did.
It has a way of sneaking into your poetry.
Yeah, definitely. Baseball and fly fishing and turtles. Those are all things I really like, and they all get in there.
Well, you live in the L.A. area. Where are you specifically in L.A.?
Glendale. Yeah, which is right between Burbank and Pasadena, both better known places.
Right. So, you know, I always think of the natural world as being a part of California life.
My love of nature, I believe, really was born in Houston, where I grew up. I lived right next to a large pine woods. And if I wasn't playing baseball, I was in the woods hunting and fishing and whatever. I mean, that's how I grew up.
And that
it was great.
Comes to play in your work so much of the time. Yeah. That's interesting that, you know, Houston was where you grew up, and that's a place where Ed Hirsch spent a lot of his time as a teacher, and yet you never met him.
I was gone by the time he was there.
And do you still have family in Houston?
My sister's still there, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
There's a lovely poem to your sister. And I do think it's beautiful. Can I have you read
it? Sure, absolutely.
Nada, I think.
Nada,
it's,
yeah.
I like this, too, because it shows a playfulness with language because of what nada means, which you explain in the poem itself.
Nada, which is N-A-D-A. What a thing to call my sister. Nada, nothing in Spanish, where D sounds like T-H, nada. Two-thirds of the way to Nathalie, where in French the TH sounds like T, as in nativity, birth, the opposite of nothing, though all who are born return to it. Nada, the word contagious, even Mom fizzing laughter as she said, don't call your sister Nada. But my gift was making fun of things. When Nada named her kitten Princess, I called her Rancidia, which stuck. My sister's preference meant Nada. Nada that morphed into nadir and nodule, lump that could be cancer and lead to the house of nothing. Nada, of whom I sang, doesn't have a head, no, not one, making Mom exclaim, don't say your sister doesn't have a head. She certainly does. Even my father laughed at that. Even he called her Nada once. Na-da, negation of da, though he'd have died for her, died for nothing and become it. Nullity, Christ denied, but Buddha embraced. Zero, nil, the void. Nada, which is heaven in a way. Nada, wondering why I've heard she's not much in my poems. Dear Nada, some say all my poems are about nothing. Worth it, too. May nothing hurt you, Nada. Better than gymnast Nadia with her perfect 10. Decades late, I confess, I was wrong. The night you played Chopin in church, Dad got it right. She's really something. Nada, who helped our parents shrink toward death while I grew fat on life. Nada, your virtues vast as space. You had a head. There was nothing wrong with you.
That was Nada from Brain Camp by Charles Harper Webb. Now there's a poem that makes you laugh in parts and then at the end get a little bit choked up.
Yeah.
So you take us full circle in the emotions.
You know, humor is so much a part of what humans are. And Shakespeare never felt he had to take the humor out of his tragedies. Looked at psychologically, it's a great defense mechanism, but it's not really just a defense mechanism. It's a way of coping. You know, it's a way of seeing the world. It's one way that you don't end up depressed all the time.
That's exactly right.
And it's a really accurate way of seeing the world.
Yeah. We've mentioned music a couple of times. You know, it was in your foreword, and then you also talked about being in a rock band. And in your book of essays, A Million MFAs Are Not Enough, you have one of the essays where you really address music and poetry, because, you know, people talk about poetry being musical. But it was real interesting to read that and see how you break it down, because when we're talking about rhythm and meter in poetry, it's a very different thing than in music itself.
It is.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that.
There's a great deal of confusion about it. Another reason I think that people are not always that interested in poetry, to put it mildly, is that a lot of poets think that they can carry a poem on just music. And I always say, if I want to hear just music, I'll put on Beethoven, I'll put on Cream, I'll put on some real music. The music of poetry is really like, it's almost a metaphor. And it's important, and I really pay attention to the way my poems sound, but it's not the most important thing. If that's all there is, I think people get bored.
Yeah, because they would be listening to music instead.
Yeah, I mean, it's the music of poetry is very limited compared to the music of music. It's a really good tool. You need to be good at it to be a good poet. But it's not Beethoven.
Right. And then the power of language is its own thing. I mean, like the way you use the root of words in that poem we just heard you read, Nada, just really kind of playing with language in so many ways. That's something that, even though you can be repetitive in music, there's no way music can ever capture that.
And language was developed to mean something. And that, in some areas, is unfashionable and seen as retrograde to think in terms of language as having meaning. We're supposed to have evolved to a point where we now see that language has no meaning. But as that last essay in the book says, I reject that idea altogether. Language has meaning. If it didn't, we wouldn't bother with it.
Exactly. I think anybody who is interested in looking at the world of poetry from a layman's perspective, A Million MFAs Are Not Enough would be a great book for people to get entrance into the poetic world, because you look at a lot of the different schools and you kind of break it down in a way for people who aren't necessarily trained. It makes it real approachable, I think.
Well, that is my intent, and I would be delighted if any single person does that. Mostly the response I've gotten have been from poets. I mean, not too many people who aren't in the field would pick up a book like that, but I wish they would.
That book is called A Million MFAs Are Not Enough, published in 2016 by Red Hen Press. We also heard Charles Harper Webb read from his poetry collections Brain Camp and Shadow Ball, both published by the University of Pittsburgh Press, which released his new book, Sidebend World, in fall 2018. For links, visit newletters.org, where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast under Ways to Listen, or find us on iTunes or Stitcher. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine at UMKC, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with Mackenzie Callahan, Danny Reeves, Cedric Hurt, Ashley Coate, and Jamie Walsh. Special thanks to Rockhurst University for bringing Charles Harper Webb to Kansas City as part of their 2017 Midwest Poet Series. And to you for listening to New Letters on the Air. I'm Angela Elam.